You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Hey, Launch Streeters, Tamara here, your host and recent discoverer of how fun axe throwing is. Seriously, if you have a place in your city, and you probably do because it's the big thing right now, go. It is an absolute blast. All right. Have you ever wondered what you need to build a real culture of innovation? I'm not talking about ping pong tables and trust falls. I'm talking about at that core level, the invisible glue that makes it all happen. Well, thanks to our guest, Yoram Solomon, it's not so invisible to us anymore. In fact, it's quite tangible. Yoram is the founder of the Innovation Culture Institute. He's published 8 books. He has 22 patents, more than 200 articles, was one of the creators of Wi-Fi and USB 3.0, named one of the top 40 innovation bloggers in 2015, 16, and 17, and is a columnist at Inc. Magazine and Innovation Excellence, and so much more. Here's what I want you to think about as you listen. How do you build accountability, autonomy, and discord? Do you have that? Does your team have that? Or are those three elements just lip service in your organization? Or maybe even not even focused on at all? That's what I want you thinking about as you listen. And hey, and remember, go to our website and get yourself your innovator archetype so that you know your unique style of innovation. This is how you begin to spread innovation across your company. It starts with you. In fact, it's a big part of a culture of innovation. It's a big part of people feeling empowered to innovate, being a part of the process, knowing where they fit into innovation. So go to GoToLaunchStreet, G-O-T-O, LaunchStreet.com, and find out how you can bring innovation to life in your way. Let's get to it. Thank you so much for being here, Yoram. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you, Tamara, for having me.
So since we're getting to know you, what's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
Well, I can tell you one thing that you'll be surprised to learn about me. I looked at your profile and we have something in common. Destination Imagination.
Oh.
I was a Destination Imagination coach for 2 years.
Oh, were you really? How old was your team? What age range were they in?
Well, kindergarten and first grade.
Oh, you are a brave, brave, patient person.
And a team of, I'm trying to remember if it was 5, 6, or 7 girls.
Oh, my goodness. But first of all, that's amazing. Just it's like herding cats at that age. But also, that program is so incredible, isn't it?
It is. It is. You know, they still remember it. And it's amazing because those girls right now are in college and they remember being in Destination Imagination. It was funny. I ran a couple of years ago, actually more than a couple of years ago, I ran for the Plano ISD school board, which, by the way, I was elected to. So I do serve there, which is another thing that probably people would be surprised to learn about me. But in one of the cases, I couldn't attend one of the panels and somebody presented me and she told the others, you know, I don't know him. I don't know anything about him. All I know is that he was coach Destination Imagination. And in my book, that's a reason to vote him to the school board.
Oh my gosh. Well, it absolutely is because the school needs more of it. And for those of you listening who don't know, go check it out. In short, it gives kids the opportunity to really flex their creative muscles and solve a whole range of problems. I'll just leave it at that for Launch Streeters. But it's an incredible program. And kudos to you for coaching a young group because they are definitely slightly more, you have to be more engaged, I'd say.
It's letting them be themselves rather than telling them, and especially the program does not let you tell them, but it's letting them be themselves, letting them be creative, showing them that you can be wrong, but it's okay and keep on trying.
Well, I think there are so many lessons that, so my now ex-husband coached my son, when he was in kindergarten and first grade, actually, in their group. And I, you know, I'd watch them, and there were so many lessons for adult about how to approach challenges and how you really think about solving things and how you, you know, kind of your perspective on creativity. And to your point, having a process where it's okay to try and fail and try and adjust, and all of those lessons I personally took away from the program as well.
Yes. You know, the retired general Stanley McChrystal, one of his saying, he did a TED talk and he said something, a good leader lets his people fail, but don't let them feel like failures.
Oh, that's wonderfully said. That's exactly it. So let's dig in, because you have a lot of expertise around creativity and innovation. So your PhD examined why people are more creative in startup companies than in mature ones. And I have a couple questions for you here. I want the kind of the top three reasons why that's the case, but I want to make sure I'm asking the question right. Because what I hear in that, in kind of what I took away from your stuff, is that it's not that the person who is creative goes to startups not to mature. It's that in that environment, they're more creative. Did I get that right?
That's right. It's perfectly right. And, you know, it's funny, because when I was looking for a topic for my dissertation, I had different topics in mind. And my mentor, I was very fortunate to have my mentor, who unfortunately passed since then. But he really pushed me to come up with something strong, something that I can use for the rest of my life. And sure enough, I am using it today. And at some point, he asked me this question. He said, what pisses you off? And, you know, I was getting pretty annoyed with him, because he kept on shooting down every idea I had for a topic.
I'm getting pissed off at you.
Exactly. That's what I wanted to say. But the words that came out of my mouth, which, by the way, I found that I do have this disconnect between my brain and my mouth. And at this point, the words out of my mouth were, what pisses me off is, why can people be so much more creative when they work in startups than when they work in mature companies? And you need to know that at that point, I had already had several startups. Some failed, some succeeded. But at that time, I was working for Texas Instruments, a company with 35,000 employees, which is anything but a startup. And I asked myself, why is that we have this contrast between the two environments? And I started researching, and, you know, I used to be annoyed when somebody would say, so what is it? And my thoughts were, my response was, I just spent 2 years global research, US, all parts of the US, China, Europe, even Israel, to try and to find the answer to that question. I published it in a 348-page dissertation, and you're asking for just one word. But what I actually found was that I can. And first of all, it comes down to innovation culture. If you don't have a culture of innovation, you will not be innovative. We tend to latch on to the latest and greatest technologies. You know, everything must have, artificial intelligence, big data,
right,
blockchain,
crowdsourcing robots, of ideas. Yep. And yeah.
Exactly. You need to have hackathons and all. That's not it. And then the next part is, so how do you, if it's not the processes, you must throw money at the problem. And it's not, because the Wright brothers were able to deliver the first heavier than air manned flying machine, which we call an airplane, for a budget of under $1,000, where right before that, Samuel Langley, who got $50,000 from the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Smithsonian Institute, failed. They actually succeeded 9 days after he declared failure. So it's not the money. What is it? And it is the innovation culture. And one of the things that I found was, if I stay at the higher level of the innovation culture, it's on the vertical axis between a supervisor and an employee. It's autonomy going down and accountability going up. And on the team level, it's the ability to construct disagreement. And those all, the ability to do each one of those tracks down to whether you have trust or not.
So will you break down a little bit, especially the accountability side for me? Because one of the things that I, like, if you asked me what pissed me off in this area, I would say, you know, for me, it is this kind of culture where not everybody feels responsible or accountable for innovation, and where it's, you know, siloed to the select five people who get to be cool and nobody else is involved. And I think that really kills the culture. So from your kind of perspective with this accountability and autonomy, how does that translate into the culture?
I think, first of all, it's It starts at the education system, which is why I ran for school board and I served there, because I do believe that we educate today, to some extent, we educate of accountability. I'll give you an example. I'm also a professor at several universities, adjunct faculty, and I have a class. This is a graduate class. And, you know, I'm sitting in a board meeting, and at 11 p.m., when I know that an assignment that I gave my students is due 11:59 p.m., at 11 p.m., I start seeing the submissions. They're submitting their assignment. They had a week to work on it, and they're submitting it in the last hour. Yeah. And so the next day I saw them in class and I asked them this question. And this is a question that really everybody needs to ask themselves. So it's 11 p.m. You started working on the assignment the last hour. You had a week. You were working on it in the last hour. And all of a sudden, internet went out, power went out, your computer crashed, and Starbucks is closed.
No, not Starbucks.
Yes. There's no Wi-Fi. And are you the next day going to give me those as excuses and ask for an extension? And I asked them, be fair, be honest with me. Raise your hand if you're going to ask for an extension and give me those as excuses. More than half my students, those are graduate students in an elite university, they raise their hands. So the problem is that that's what we teach. We tell them that, you know, you can come up with an excuse and it's going to be fine. You know, mommy and daddy are going to cover up for you. But it really starts with you realizing that you have to be accountable. It doesn't matter what job you have. You don't have to be one of those five people who have the word innovation or design in their title. Everybody. And it's funny because that ended up being the title for my seventh book, Culture Starts With You.
I like that. So one of the things that I read in one of the articles you wrote, which kind of relates to this, was that extrinsic motivation actually kills creativity and innovation. Talk to me a little bit about that, because I do think, and I'm sure you even see this more than I do, that sometimes I feel like I go in to help with, you know, innovation in companies and they've got all these incentive programs to try to drive new ideas and innovation and, you know, whatever skunk works and stuff. But you kind of have this whole point about those things are actually not only are they not helping it, but they're actually killing it.
That's right. And it's amazing. The you know, there's something, this dates back to, I think, 1947, if I remember correctly, something that's called the candle problem. And the candle problem is where you would get a group of items. So you would get a candle, match, a box of thumbtacks, and the what you're challenged with is how do you get the candle stuck to the wall, light it up, and not have it drip wax on the floor. And so there is a creative way to look at it, but in order for you to be creative, you need to see the big picture, and you need to see the box of thumbtacks, not only as a box of thumbtacks, but as a box, comma, thumbtacks. Because only once you see the box as its own entity, then you realize, oh, I can get the box stuck to the wall with two thumbtacks or more, and then put the candle on it, light the candle, and it's not going to drip. So that task requires some creativity. Now, if on the other hand, what I put in front of you are the candle, the matches, the box, and the thumbtacks outside of the box, you already see the box as a separate entity. It just becomes a very mechanical task to put it together. So then they started experimenting, and this experimentation took place in the 60s. The experimentation was, what happens if we incentivize people, like you're going to get $20 if you're the first person to solve this problem. Now, if we separated thumbtacks from the box and we let you try it, so when it's a pure mechanical problem, incentives drive performance. So you're going to get people to do it faster, much faster, but they already know how to do it. Remember, in this case, it's just a mechanical problem. But an interesting thing happened when you tried the opposite, and that is the thumbtacks are still in the box. So now it's not a mechanical problem. It's a creativity problem. You need to think outside the box, no pun intended, but you need to think. And in this case, when you offered a financial incentive, performance went down. Now, this was repeated in different, Tana Rieli, who's another Israeli Now teaching at, I believe he's teaching at Duke now, behavioral economics. He did research like that for the Federal Reserve Bank, found exactly the same thing. When you try to incentivize creativity, you fail. You actually reduce the level of creativity that you have. Creativity has to be motivated intrinsically. You have to want to do this.
So can you, this may be a backwards question, but if I have a team and I know they have it in them, but maybe that we haven't had the right culture, we're trying to make that transition, how do I get them to unlock that intrinsic motivation if maybe it's there, but it's been squelched for a while?
Well, one of the things, and you brought this up at some point, Skunkworks. Skunkworks is an interesting, Skunkworks is actually a trademark by Lockheed Martin now, but it was created by Clarence or Kelly Johnson. And this is a group that works in the hardest industry to work in, very formalized, very procedural oriented, the defense industry. And in that group came up with some of the inventions that you know we've never seen since, not at that time. I mean, this is the group that created the first American fighter jet. They created the U-2 spy plane, the SR-71 spy plane that flies three times the speed of sound, and they created the F-117 stealth fighter. All of this came from a group that is working in the most formalized industry in the world. How does that happen? Well, their leader, Kelly Johnson, and then the others who followed, shielded their organization from everything else that's happening in the company and in the industry. So a big part of what you do to drive success is your ability to shield your team from everything negative. And I want to tell you a story if we have the time.
Yeah, of course.
So I'm working as an executive in a company, and this is, I think, 6-7 years ago. I was working as an executive, and our CEO decided to bring in a tool called Crosspoint. And what Crosspoint did was to allow us to track our engineering time. So we know every engineer at every point in time, what were they working on, what project, so we can be the right customer. Well, I just came off the PhD research knowing that bureaucracy kills creativity. And we just added an element of bureaucracy. So, you know, don't do that. Don't put bureaucracy on them. And we got into, there's no other way to describe it other than a fight. We got into a fight during that meeting where I really stood my ground against using Crosspoint to track the time of engineers, because that kills their creativity. And we need those engineers to be creative. Well, the CEO at that time, eventually he said, no, we're going to use it. Period. So, you know, I lost that battle. I tried to still win another battle saying my team really only works on one project. And this was our own Skunkworks project. So my team only works on this. So why does my team need to fill their time? Well, no, everybody in the company has to do that. Period. This is it.
Right.
So, you know, then about a month later, our budget manager came to the meeting and reported, and he always complained to all the general managers and vice presidents in the company that their employees were not feeling time in Crosspoint. After 3 months of that, he reported again, and he looks at me and he said, Yoram, I don't get this. You were the one who fought really, really hard against your engineers using a Crosspoint, yet your team is the only team that every week fills in their time in Crosspoint, no errors, no mistakes, no complaints. How come? And I said, well, it's pretty simple. Actually, if you check the report, you're going to find that all of my employees entered their time within the same 30 minutes. And he said, really? That's, and he looks at it and,
it's like clockwork.
And he confirms. And he said, how does that happen? And I said, I don't know. You ask them, but I just want to prepare you. If you ask them, how do you all of my employees, how do you all enter your time into Crosspoint at the same time every week? Their answer is going to be, what exactly is Crosspoint? I realized that bureaucracy kills creativity in my team. So it was my job to shield them and not let this piece of bureaucracy going. I let budget going. I let funding going. I let all the resources going. None of the other crap.
That is a great lesson for launch traders out there listening who lead teams, regardless of if your job is, you know, a Skunkworks innovation team or just admin, like help. What I hear you saying that I think is so important is really give your team the room and the ability to be creative and drive that innovation and not get bogged down in all the crap that, you know, becomes the big company processes that we all get kind of sucked into. And to the, you know, was it your boss or the CEO that said, well, everybody has to do it? That's such a myopic view of how and why you should use any of the tools in your company, don't you think?
That's right. I'll tell you another short story. My older daughter was a gymnast, and she was, by the way, she was on my Destination Imagination team when she was in kindergarten.
Such a good
and
program.
She was a gymnast, and she went to a lot of state meets. And in one of those state meets, I sat with her, and she was in there, and I saw the father of one of her friends, Megan. And so I sat next to him. I knew that he was Megan's dad. And I don't know if he knew that I was Maya's dad. And so I went to him, introduced myself. You know, I'm Maya's dad. And I understand that you're Megan's dad. And he said, yes, my name is Ed. And I asked him, Ed, where do you work? I mean, he was wearing a sweatshirt and sweatpants, so you couldn't tell where he worked or what he did. And I asked him, where do you work? And he said, I work for Alliance Data. Now, if you're not familiar, Alliance Data is a very large software company. They made more than $6 billion a year in revenue in the last several years. I don't know where they are now. I'm sure that they do more. And I asked him, so what do you do in Alliance Data? And he said, I am the head cheerleader. Mm. So I thought that's an interesting statement.
Different.
So I asked him, are you the CEO? And he said, yes. And I never thought much of this until, I guess it was a couple of years later, I was sitting in an executive staff meeting where the CEO was berating all of the executives, not the employees, the executives, for not doing what he's asking them to do. And from this moment on, you're going to do exactly what I do, what I tell you to, exactly when I tell you to, and so on. He left the room, the conference room, and I looked at everybody else. They were demotivated. They were borderline depressed. I went to his office, closed the door, and I asked, why did you do that? Why did you come down on them so hard? I mean, they're demotivated. They're probably working on their resumes right now. And he said, you know why? Because I'm the goddamn CEO, not a cheerleader. And all of a sudden, that word comes up again, a cheerleader. And I started thinking, you know, let's do some research. And what I found was that Ed Heffernan, the CEO for Alliance Data, and the CEO of this company, both took them as the CEOs of their companies within 6 months of one another, 11 years earlier. So very similar time. They both took a public technology company with a stock price of around $14. Ed Heffernan took his Alliance Data from $14 to, at the time I wrote this article for Inc. magazine, to $250. And his company was the best place to work on or one of the top 100 places to work on at DFW for 5 years in a row. The other CEO took his company from $14 a share all the way to bankruptcy three years
later.
Oh,
wow. Wow. That's a big difference.
It is.
And do you think that having that leadership at the top that really recognizes that their job is to, I don't want to say get out of the way and let their people do what they do best, but also recognize that that people do it differently and their way isn't the only way? Because there's kind of another layer to that story, isn't there? That there's this kind of, and I see this all the time, particularly with innovation, there's this challenge that leaders say, we want to be innovative, and then they tell them how they're supposed to be innovative versus letting them figure it out on their own in some ways. Like, you know, from the DI team and from corporate, we all approach it a little bit differently. It's not always the same.
So a great point. And Teresa Amabile, who's a professor in Harvard, and I used a lot of the research that she has done when I worked on my own dissertation and ever since, she had a very good definition for autonomy. And she said, autonomy is not telling your employees, it's not letting your employees decide which mountain to climb, but it's letting them decide how to climb that mountain. But in terms of, does it have to start with the CEO? It really doesn't, because I don't know where Lockheed Martin would have been and whether the CEO was like Kelly Johnson. What it takes is one leader at one level of the organization to shield his team or her team from the rest of the organization, and that makes that team creative. So it doesn't necessarily have to have at the top, the absolute top.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think leadership comes from all levels of the organization. And I love what you were saying about, it's not about deciding which mountain. I mean, that's kind of where the vision and the direction of the company sits, but how you get to climb that mountain. And kind of on a side note, it's fascinating to hear you talk because, you know, we have our innovation quotient edge assessment that tells you your innovator archetype, because our contention is that, and what we've really discovered in our research is that everybody can be innovative, but how we innovate is different for each of us. So we're all a little bit unique. And I'm laughing a little bit because your power triggers are inquisitive and futuristic. And, yes. You know, I keep hearing it in your language of like, so I wondered, so I asked, so I, you know, question this and I question that, because inquisitives innovate by digging deep and pulling back the layers and challenging assumptions and asking questions. But it also made me think about, I'm a risk taker experiential, and you and I would approach something, we would get up that mountain very differently. And as a team, we could probably do it even better because we have different skills that we bring to the table. And I think when you, to your point with the autonomy, open the room up to allow people to, particularly when it comes to innovation and creativity, do it in their way that works for them, you can get incredible stuff. And I think it goes back to what you're saying earlier, that intrinsic motivation is actually strengthened as well, because you're playing from a place that works for you versus trying to do it somebody else's way.
And you actually brought up an interesting point when you talked about the team. Up until now, I talked about the leader versus the team. Yeah. But if we talk about the team, you have a different style than I do. You have different cognitive abilities than I do. It's not that one of them is better and one of them is worse,
they're
but they're different. And so I talk a lot. Actually, most of what I do is at the team level. And that is, how can you conduct what I call a constructive disagreement? And for that, first of all, you know, one of the sentences that I hate, that I really hate, there are two that I really hate, but one of them is, let's agree to disagree.
Yeah.
Don't use that.
It's kind of a lazy way out, don't you think?
Yeah. It's like, you know what, Tamara, you hold your position, I'll hold mine, and we'll just split that. Because then what happens is we have the meeting before the meeting after the meeting, just not the meeting during the meeting.
Right.
And we never reach something that productive or creative. The other statement that I really hate is, you know, if I told you now that if I asked you, can I ask a stupid question, what would your immediate answer be? There is no such thing as a stupid question, right?
Yeah.
Yes, there is. Yes, there are. 80% of my questions are stupid, but if you tell me that there is no such thing as a stupid question, you actually kind of pigeonholed both of us, because, you know, then I asked my question, which, as it turns out, happens to be in the 80% and is pretty much stupid. But you can't say that anymore. And not to mention that you gave me a false sense of security that whatever I ask, it can't be stupid. And it's not true. In order for us to be able to hold a constructive disagreement, there are three things that each one of us must be willing to do. One is, we must be vulnerable. Tamara, I must be able to ask a stupid question and not worry about what you're going to do with that question, not worry that it's going to come back to bite me. The second thing is, I need to be willing to give you direct feedback on your question. And your question can be stupid, and I need to be able to tell you this was a stupid question and not worry about your reaction.
Right.
And the third thing is, be receptive for kind of feedback from you. If you tell me that my question was stupid, I need to not clam down, not say, okay, I don't want to hear anymore, let's agree to disagree. I need to be receptive and listen to the feedback that you give me.
Let me ask you a question about this, because I'm smiling as you're talking, because one of my big frustrations that I think actually falls into this is, we bought into this myth that I think we have to surround ourselves with yes and people. And the people who say yes but don't get it, they're not innovative, they're stuck in status quo. And I don't actually think that's true. I think we need both to really get to a better place with our thinking. You need the people who agree with you and get it. And then, frankly, you need the people who disagree with you and poke holes in it, because there are holes. You're not seeing everything, right? You're one person. So How do we transition a culture where, you know, and I see this all the time where people say, like, you have language around your questions. I have a clarifying question, Yoram. Like, it's not just a question. I have to, like, preface it with something, and everybody needs to be in a yes and mood. So if that's the kind of team I work in or what I've bought into, and frankly, that's a lot of the organizations that we work with, to no fault of their own, it's through a lot of years of training. How do you get them out of that? How do you train constructive disagreement?
So first of all, there is a lot of value in yes and. And the reason there is a lot of value is if you ever did improv, and I did improv.
Yes, yeah, one of my favorite exercises is the yes and
if
game.
If you don't have someone that you can do a yes and with, I mean, you're stuck in front of an audience, and that's not a very comfortable situation to be in. But having said that, have you watched the TV series, The West Wing?
Yes, it has been so many years, but yes.
I know. You can still get it, I think.
And I'm not young, but yes.
I love this. And there is a part there. This is, and I'm not going into politics here, just to be clear, but this happens with the Democratic White House, and the chief of staff is about to hire or makes an offer to a young lady by the name of Ainsley Hayes. And she's a lawyer and she's a Republican. And she sits there and he's trying to make it clear that he's not trying to, show her off or tell her that she did something wrong. But he wants to offer her a job. And he asks her at some point, do you want to work at the White House? And she goes, ever since I was 2 years old. And he said, so, and she says, it has to be this White House, because the Democratic White House means she's a Republican. And he says, Ainsley, and this is one of the smartest sentences I've ever heard. And I actually bring that short video clip into a lot of my keynotes that I give. He says this, Ainsley, the president wants to surround himself with smart people who disagree with him. So this is one of the questions that people have to ask themselves. Do you want to surround yourself with smart people who disagree with you? Or do you want to surround yourself with people who just say yes?
Yeah. Well, that's my issue with the culture of yes and. I agree with you. I think having people who will elevate the idea and continue to improve and build with you is great. But I think that we really miss the mark when we're only surrounded by yes people.
That's right.
Yeah. So I want to, just in the essence of time, I want to go into a couple of things that I want to make sure to ask about, because when I read them, one of them surprised me and one of them I thought, yes, this is exactly what I've been trying to say in some other areas, and I'd love to hear you talk about it. So you, in one of the articles that I read, you were talking about how great ideas appear accidental. You actually need to create an environment where more of those accidents happen. So talk a little bit about that and kind of what you've seen allow those accidents to happen.
You know, it's funny where it came from, because it was when I started on my own, this happened to be the most sought after keynote that I gave. And the title for that was Why Do You Get Your Best Ideas in the Shower? And I actually went through the psychology and neuroscience of idea generation, specifically combinational creativity, to find exactly it. And there is a reason why it happened in the shower, why it happens when you drive a long period of time. But it really started when I was working for this company and I presented to the board of directors a new idea. And the board just embraced it. They wanted to use that. And this was be the future of the company. And one of the board members followed me to my office and he said, you know, this is a great idea. You don't know how fortunate we are. Something like this happens only once in a lifetime for a company.
Right.
And I thought, wait, I'm trying to think, there's a reason why I have 22 patents. These things happen to me more. It doesn't, but it makes sense when he said, this happens once in a lifetime because great ideas are accidental. I ask myself, are they accidental? And I do believe that they are. I do believe that your brain fires up in the medial prefrontal cortex and old ideas merge into a new idea. This is kind of accidental. You don't control it, but you can put yourself in a situation where the probability of those accidents are higher. And one of the analogies I like to use is, let's say that you want to ride your bike and you want to have an accident. God knows why, but you want to have an accident today. Maybe insurance, but I don't know what. But so you ride your bike in the bike trails in the park. you're not going to have an accident.
Right.
However, if you want to drive it and, you're up in Colorado there, I don't know if you have Highway 70 or 75. What's the one
70,
that goes down to Colorado?
70.
70 to Colorado Springs. I got my MBA at Colorado Springs.
I-25 is what you're talking about. Yeah.
25. So yeah. We're going down 25. What happens if you would go on your bike on the 25 at 8 a.m.? You will
hit.
Have an accident in the first 5 minutes.
Right.
So this is accidental, but apparently if you can control the environment, you can increase the probability of those accidents. And so I started researching, and I researched all the way to a book that was published in 1939. And I developed this model of four steps. The first step is you have, in order for you to be able to, through combinational creativity, create new ideas in your brain, you must have old ideas in your brain. So the first thing you need to do is you just need to immerse yourself in things that are outside of your comfort zone, things that, you know, you don't typically read about. By the way, science fiction, great way to come up with creative ideas. You remember the first episode of Star Trek, 1966? You remember what Spock had in ear?
It was the Bluetooth.
It was a Bluetooth headset. 33 years before anybody started working on the
anything
Bluetooth
on Star Trek, right? They had the iPad. They've got, like, they had a bunch of stuff. The flat
iPad,
screens.
iPhones. And, and stuff we don't have yet. So
everything we have is due to Star Trek.
You have to immerse yourself in ideas, collect old ideas. That's step one. Step two is actually pretty easy. It's just relax. Just let those ideas incubate in your head, because they're going to find the right time. Step four is really to take a shower, because when you're taking a shower or driving for a long period of time, this is when your brain gets into this neutral mode, and that's when your medial prefrontal cortex does not engage in executive functionality or controlling functionality, but really allows itself to combine. Now, I know that I skipped number three. Number three is to engage in an intense activity. The reason for that is our brain really doesn't just need to be in neutral. It needs to go to neutral from a very high intensity activity. So for me, it used to be flying. I used to fly full-size airplanes. Now I fly radio control airplanes. You know, when you fly an 11-pound plane at 130 miles per hour, you can't even blink. Those are intense, very intense activities. After an activity like this, if you go into a shower or drive to the same place that you've been driving to day in, day out, when, you know, you drive in autopilot pretty much, that's when you have ideas. So there is a four-step process, and it's collect old ideas, let them incubate, engage in an intense activity, and then relax in a shower or driving. That's how you increase the probability of having those accidents.
So it's so funny you say that, because or interesting, I guess. So I do CrossFit, which is high intensity. And I go at 5 o'clock in the morning, and then I drive home. And I've come to realize that I needed to keep a notebook in my car, because I constantly have ideas at 6:15 in the morning when I'm driving back from CrossFit. But it's kind of what you were saying. It's that combination of high intensity and then introspection, kind of autopilot time, where I'm not thinking about much. And I swear every time I drive home and I'm like, oh my God, that's how I solve that. It just cracks me up every time.
And now you know why.
Yeah.
And by the way, the two tools that help with that, a digital voice recorder in your car, and in the shower, there is actually, there's paper, there are notebooks.
Ooh, I have
and
it.
Pencils that you
Aqua Notes, so I think it's called, right?
Exactly.
Yes, it's like my favorite thing ever is the Aqua. I have a whole closet of them. They're so good. Okay, so that was so interesting. And I really appreciate and launch readers, I hope you're listening to the idea that, maybe it's accidental, but you can actually make those accidents more likely, which, I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't want to wait another 10 years for my next big idea. And the world is moving too fast for that model. So we have to keep innovating all the time.
Right.
So the other thing I wanted to ask you about, because this one surprised me, is you had talked about some of the kind of the important things when it comes to innovation. And one of the things that you mentioned was sarcasm.
Yes.
Talk to me about that, because I was like, well, I've never heard that before.
Actually, it's not necessarily that sarcasm causes innovation. It is sarcasm uses the same area of the brain that allows you to be creative. And so it's just that there was a correlation between people who use sarcasm, and I use it a lot, people who use sarcasm and creativity that comes out of those people. But in that article that that you read, I also cautioned against when you can use sarcasm and when you can't. I just had an interesting experience this last weekend. I wrote a kind of sarcastic, humoristic comment on Facebook in a group that I'm very familiar with, but there was one person in that group really took it the wrong way. And when I say he took it the wrong way, it's really not his fault. It's my fault for not recognizing that not everybody in that group knows my sense of humor. And therefore, maybe that was a little too much. So when you have a team that's really bonded well together, it's going to be a creative team if that team can really use sarcasm and not worry about it. When they have to worry about that, then you still have some work to do to gel this team and turn it into a very creative team that can really hold, again, a constructive disagreement.
So you've mentioned trust a couple times now through the conversation. Is trust important? Because that is what allows you to be yourself on the team and not, you know, not kind of worry about being what you're not or saying the right thing or saying what, you know, hopefully is the smart thing versus the stupid thing, about being willing to kind of take risks. Like, why is, I don't want to be assumptive. I mean, I know we've all heard that trust is important, but from your perspective, because you have a little bit of a different angle, why does trust, why is that at the underlying of all of it?
Okay, so yeah, it's not just that it's important. It is the underlying element that, and if I go back to autonomy, let's start with autonomy.
Yeah.
Would you give your employees autonomy? Well, only if I trust them, right?
Right, yeah, totally.
So trust is important. You have to have trust. Accountability or risk-taking. Are you willing to take risks and then walk to your boss and say, I tried something without your permission and failed? Only if you trust that that boss is not going to make it really, really painful.
Right.
How about a constructive disagreement? Are you willing to be vulnerable with me? Only if you trust me that this is not going to come back and bite you. Are you willing to give me direct feedback? Only if you trust that I'm not going to take it personally, emotionally, and become
right.
irrational.
And I'm only willing to receive that feedback if I trust that you're coming from a good place. Or the
right
place.
Yeah. That I'm not trying to hurt you, that I'm not doing that to offend you or anything. So trust is the basis for everything here. And one of the things, and we probably don't have time for today, but one of the things that I've developed over the last 10 years is actually a formula that helps you build trust. How do you build trust between every two people?
That's fantastic. That is for another time, but maybe we can put a link in our show notes to kind of wherever, maybe on your website, that at least talks about trust. Because I do think particularly when it comes to innovation, but performance overall, I think as a team, I mean, if you don't trust each other, that's where you start to see things fall apart. And it's one of those topics or words that gets thrown around. It's very subjective and people don't really know what to do with it. So if we can have a link maybe to send just to your thoughts on trust, that would be fantastic. So, okay. So
definitely.
Before we go, where can people go to learn more and connect with you?
Well, the place I would go to is the www.innovationcultureinstitute.com or .net or .org or innovationculture.institute. But in general, wherever you're going to look for the Innovation Culture Institute, you're going to find me.
Excellent. Now, the last question for you is, what's the one piece of advice you have for launch readers out there that are looking to ignite more creativity?
Well, first of all, the question is it creativity at the team level, at the organization level, or at the individual level? If it's at the individual level, those are the four advices I gave you on why you get your best ideas in the shower. Collect old ideas, let them incubate, intense activity, and then a relaxing activity. If it's how to build, which is what my focus is on today, how to build trust within an organization or innovation culture within an organization, it starts with building trust. You know, don't worry about anything else. Start with building trust. And there is a formula for that. Again, go to my website. You'll see more about that. But that's where you need to focus. Focus on building trust first. Now, I have another piece of advice for you.
Yeah.
I looked up your profile in your website and I found that you want to be played by Gal Gadot.
I mean, who wouldn't?
Well, I wouldn't, I think, but it's just, I have a friend that I just found after many, many years, and he used to be my best friend, and yeah. I think we're going to build this again. He's from Israel. He even lost track of the fact that I left Israel 20 years ago.
Yeah.
He has his own company called Gravity. Gravity.co.il. And what they do is they do a lot of commercials, a lot of creative work. And it just the first commercial that I saw, he shot with Gal Gadot. Oh. So I can put you in touch with
him. Oh, my
him
gosh. And, stop it. You've made my dreams come true. Movie. Oh, my gosh. Well, and I will tell you, I mean, it's, you know, I think my listeners know that I'm, you know, originally from Israel, so Israeli and American. And I was laughing when the Wonder Woman came out. I was like, oh, my God, maybe, like, you know, I have the same coloring, the same kind of hair. I was like, maybe they'll call me to play her mother in the About story. Like,
By the way, I don't want her to play me. I would just go with either Matt Damon or Brad Pitt. I'm good with those.
Well, I would like her to play me, and I'm happy to be her Ima. Like, totally on board with both. So, because she is amazing. But anyways, thank you for sharing that. Because you never know. Maybe when that time comes, I'll be like, yes, I know exactly who you should reach out to.
That's right.
Well, Yoram, this has been fantastic. Tons of insights to take away. So I hope our listeners kind of, you know, took a pause and got out of their cars and grabbed their notes and kind of really dug in, because I really appreciate that, not only the kind of global or bigger perspective on innovation, but also the real tangible things that people can walk away and do. So thank you.
Thank you, Tamara. I hope we brought value today.
So interesting. What do you think about the three? Accountability, autonomy, discord, disagreement. Yoram and I talked about so much, but these three elements really stood out to me. And now that you've thought about it, what are you going to do about it? What actions are you going to take on those three or anything else you heard in the podcast? I know one. You're going to go to our blog page on our website and check out all the videos and articles that we have on building a culture of innovation. This will help put you on the path. Tamara out.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, launchstreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.